My name is Jane Rossing, and this forum is on, in a world of problems, what's your priority? And we're going to start with some panelists tonight, Al Pitcher, Jackie Goldsma, Dick Hayne, and Tom Witt. The way that this forum came up is that we find that many people come to Holden and are bombarded with issues of peace and justice, which are very important, and often feel that what they really want is a place of renewal. They have family problems. They feel that they are wounded, and that's much more important. Other people are faced with a conflict, the tension between environmental problems, and should we work on that when we have so many people that are suffering from great poverty? So we want to start with these four people who are going to share what they have taken on as priorities, if we can say that, and how they've decided. And then I think we'll have plenty of chance for you all to share how you decide what to put your energy into in the world today. So we're going to start with Al.
When I first came to Holden in September, I had 11 issues that interested me. And since that time, I've raised it to 29. But for some unknown reason, I started to work on the environment, and I'd like to try to explain why I think that's the place to begin. I think there are four main categories of issues. One is the physical, chemical, biological stuff of life. The second are the social institutions of life. The third would be the personal, interpersonal relations. And the fourth would be what I call the spiritual or the religious. I really do believe that the substance of Western culture is the primary issue today. That is, I believe that the values of Western culture will destroy the world, destroy the chemical, physical, biological reality. We will no longer have a world in which we can live. And the fundamental issue is religious. It's the substance, it's the values, it's the meaning structure. And anyone who's read Habits of the Heart realizes that the middle class in America comes out of a focus on the individual, what they call ontological individualism. That is, the fundamental reality is the individual. And for me, that is simply the worst of heresies, to begin with oneself as the fundamental, and I could spend quite a bit of time on that. But the way I think the issue arises for us is that the result of this focus on ourselves and upon the creation of a world of things, and regardless of the environment, is that we are destroying the physical, chemical, biological base for life. And I think the fundamental, one of the fundamental issues is global warming. The fact is that we are increasing the temperature. And according to one scenario, we will increase the temperature from 5 to 30 degrees in the next 100 years. And they call it the inferno. If we continue to use fossil fuels at the rate we are, and some of the other greenhouse gases, we will simply create such an environment of a greenhouse that the temperature will go up, and we'll have it'll be an impossible. There are all kinds of scenarios. I have in here a scenario: what happens to San Francisco Bay and all the areas that will be changed by simply 60 centimeters, 2 feet rise in the sea level. And the prediction is anywhere from 2 feet to 10 feet, it will go up in the next 100 years. The ocean will go up. All of San Francisco Bay, I mean, they just diagrammed what's going to be underwater. And I use that, but you could go all over the world. In Bangladesh, half of Bangladesh will disappear with the increase in temperature, and all kinds of climate changes, which will change the growing places, the belts of growing will move into Canada that are now in the central plains of the United States because of the increase in temperature. And the hurricanes will increase, and you will have all kinds of stuff happening. That's one scenario, 5 to 30 degrees. If we decrease our carbon dioxide emissions, there's a chance that it'll only be 5 degrees. And I would say we ought to decrease our carbon emissions from coal, oil, and gas 80% within 10 years. 80%. 80%. And you know what that means. All our electricity, big culprit. Anyway, the other scenario is that it's going to get cold. On the same grounds that carbon dioxide is going to warm up the Earth, and it will warm the equator more than the poles, will create a wind cycle of the moisture that evaporates from the oceans at the equator will be carried north. A lot of it will be dropped as it goes, and we'll have a lot more rain in some places, and particularly in the spring, and the summers will be hot, and so we'll have a lot of floods in the spring. But it would go to the North Pole and form ice, and so we're in for an ice age. Either scenario, both scenarios depend upon the increase in carbon dioxide and a few other, methane and chlorofluorocarbon. Both scenarios, either scenario is disastrous. And the solution is the same, practically the same. Get rid of the greenhouse gases. Change our whole lifestyle so we don't need all of the energy that we have now. And act radically with all kinds of new things. Renault and Peugeot have just united with the French government in a $200 million project to build cars that run on hydrogen. And I think we're spending $17 million in this country on that product. I mean, we have no sense. You talk about addiction. We are denying the reality of what is happening to our... We are addicted, as I understand the way addicted. And until we realize we're addicted, there is no hope. And part of the reason we're addicted is we don't want to give up our style of life. We don't want to give up the values that are creating this. And finally, that's the issue. That's the issue. Our religion is the issue. Our religion. I don't see how anybody can live in this world today with 1.2 billion people in poverty and all the things that created and take his or her Christianity seriously. That's enough.
Second. When I lived in Fort Worth, Texas, I was teaching in seminary, and I made choices different than I'm making today. At that time, I was a member of whole bunches of groups, which you could tell if you saw my range of t-shirts. I was involved in Nuclear Freeze, Fellowship of Reconciliation, National Organization for Women, the ACLU, what else? Sanctuary Movement, Gay and Lesbian Concerns, Amnesty International, and so forth. I did that because of my commitments, but also for practical reasons. It gave me contacts in all those communities. I knew what was going on. I took students in seminary and said, you need to learn something about the black community, and the person you need to talk to is X. And X would talk to them because I had credibility with X because I had spent time there, I had done supportive things, I had given money, I had put myself on the line for those communities, and so I had access for my students. So part of my reason for spreading myself over all of those things was a kind of educational strategy. I think all of the issues we're going to talk about, including interpersonal, are connected. I was struck by the House and Senate having Arms Control and Foreign Policy Caucus. And about a year ago or so, they came out, well, August of 89, that's not even a year. They came out with a report in which they said, it's kind of interesting. Let me just read you two sentences from it. First sentence is in the summary of findings. The developing world, the concern here is the third world, faces five serious challenges: economic, environmental, political power of the military, militarization, that is to say war, military spending, and so forth, and drug trafficking. Hey, you know, it leaves out the interpersonal, but they're talking about, you know, political, at the kind of political level. And the second point is, the problems of the developing world pose an immediate and far-reaching threat to U.S. security. As I see it, the issues are not primarily east and west, they're primarily north and south. I don't want to make a case for poverty and hunger over against any of the other ones, because they're all important, okay? And they are all interconnected. If I were to try to make a case for poverty and hunger, I would cite some of these things. One, 40,000 people die every single day of hunger and hunger-related diseases. That's the equivalent of a Hiroshima bomb every 2 or 3 days in the third world. Two, all of the wars since World War II, with the exception of Russia's invasion of some Central European countries, all of the wars since World War II have been fought in third world countries. Primary problem of militarism is a third world problem. That's where the battles are fought, that's where people die, that's where a lot of our money goes too, as a matter of fact. I have gone with poverty and hunger issues partly because that's where I got a job. Although I turned down a much better job in classical American terms in a social service agency because I wanted to do justice rather than service. I stick with poverty and hunger because it's less popular. I think that there's a wide American constituency for environmental concerns. I think a lot of middle and upper class people get into it. There's a lot of money in the movement. I think that's also true in the peace movement, although the peace movement right now is experiencing a real crisis because everybody was geared up for Russia. And now that we're de-escalating, the peace organizations in D.C. are having a hard time because they're having to cut staff, they're losing money, everybody thinks the war's over, which of course is silly. But nonetheless, it is. I think those things catch the middle class imagination and upper class imagination better, and therefore they make very good church issues. I prefer to stick with what seemed to me the place that is less popular, the place of politics, the place of poverty. I think that all four of these things get at the central value questions. Al and I would agree that the problem is the substance of Western culture. But I think personally that poverty addresses the substance of Western culture more fundamentally. That is to say, you can be an upper class person working for the environment. You can be, and often are, an upper class person working against war. But if you're working for and with the poor, it's very hard to maintain the basic orientation that characterizes Western culture, because it comes back to you as a continual kind of judgment and you're dealing with information and people. So I do think one should choose things where you can get institutional handles. That's one of the principles. In the if you've got some way of getting institutional handles on something, that is a criterion, whichever kind of issue you go with. And I think it's better to focus your activity rather than spread yourself around. I think what I did in Fort Worth is generally very bad policy. That is, take one thing and stick with it and get to know it. And if I have 2 or 3 people at Holden Village, I can make something happen on poverty and hunger issues. If I have 2 or 3 people in your church who are willing to stick with one issue, we can make something happen in your church, little by little. But if you get spread around, what you get is you get a lot of activity, and you get a lot of motion, and you feel good because you feel like you're doing a lot of stuff. The question is, what are the results? What actual results accrue from all that running around? The answer is often very little, except the feeling that you've done a lot, which you have. You've done a lot of doing.
I agree 100% with that.
One last sentence, very briefly. I'm at Bread for the World, and I chose Bread for the World, and of course, partly they chose me. Partly because it's a faith community, it's not just a secular organization. because it has the power to affect change, we do actually change public policy. We do actually change the world marginally. I mean, by little bits. I chose Bread for the World because when I go organizing, I network with a community of activists all over this country, and it is wonderful. And they're in every city in this country. And I gotta say that working there has been a gift. To me, the difference between teaching in a seminary where class pervades over gospel, at least that's my judgment about the seminary I was in, where class prevails over gospel, and working at Bread for the World, where we have interpersonal community, where they are missing me right now. When I get back, I'm going to be hugged in my workplace, and I'm going to be there with people who have lived and worked in Africa for 10 years, with people who have done a variety of different things, with people who, on the large, are making $10,000 and $20,000 a year sacrifice, or $30,000 or $40,000 a year sacrifice in order to be doing that kind of work. People who are rooted in certain value premises and are willing to work together in behalf of justice. And that's a wonderful place to work. So when you're thinking about it, if you can find that kind of community, whether they're doing environment or whether they're doing peace work, that is a wonderful gift to participate in.
Someone might be an idol, though.
What?
Nothing.
Well, I...
No reply, please.
I work for one of these fledgling peace organizations that are going under. While I'm speaking, we'll be passing a hat. Raise my salary. I work alone primarily, so I'm not going to get hugged when I get back home. But I've been working for a peace organization in the church for about 7 years now. So I guess I've been asked to talk about militarism and why I focused on that. And I think in this context, I could say that as I look at the variety of issues out there and analyze them, it seems like so many of them come back to militarism in my mind, that militarism has an adverse effect on most other social issues. It has such a far-reaching impact on almost everything else, and I'll just quickly try to highlight them. I mean, the obvious one is the possibility of nuclear war and all that entails for the environment and for us as humans. But even without that, the number of wars has been increasing steadily ever since the advent of the atomic bomb. 1980s, there were more wars than in any other decade in history. There are more war deaths. Most of them are civilians. Most of those wars are in the third world. The major hunger problem today is not lack of food, but is war, I think.
Right.
You can cite all sorts of statistics. One soldier for every 250 inhabitants in the third world versus one doctor for every 2,000. The world's annual military budget equaling the gross income of the poor half of humanity. Arms exporting, most of our arms exporting is, most of over half of our aid goes directly to, as military aid or indirect assistance to help military allies. Less than one-fourth of that really reaches poor people. Environmentally, weapons of war, even when they're not used, create their own dangers, everything from nuclear testing down to toxic waste. We don't often acknowledge the fact that the United States military is the single largest source of toxic waste in this nation. War creates refugees, which undoubtedly has effect on the environment as well as those human beings, and relates to hunger. Domestically, militarism helps create a huge federal debt, where we're forced to borrow money just to pay for those weapons. Those weapons are paid for also by cuts in domestic programs, which relates back to families, children, cuts like low-income housing, just tremendous that the military budget, in essence, is paid for by cuts in social spending, so that poverty should be understood as not an accident, but a consequence of sacrificing programs that help poor people in order to support a monstrous military budget. Militarism contributes to inflation. It creates unemployment. It weakens our industrial infrastructure by taking a disproportionate share of both capital resources and expertise out of other industries, so that our infrastructure is crumbling and we're not competitive anymore in the world. That's why we see Japan moving ahead of us economically. We don't make the things we need anymore. We make things that we don't want and can never use, weapons, but we don't make shoes. 80% of our shoes, 85% of our shoes are made in other countries. Televisions, VCRs, anything that we use is now made in other parts of the world, largely, I think, because of militarism. The second reason that I think I need to focus on militarism is in relation to these other issues is that if you're concerned about these other issues, at some point you're going to need resources to work on them, particularly the environment and hunger. You're going to need resources, money and people, particularly the money. The resources are in the military budget right now. I don't think we'll ever be able to solve any kind of domestic problems or the environmental problem without the resources that are in the military budget right now. $302 billion proposed for this year. Literally half of our scientists are working directly or indirectly on military projects. 75% of our research and development money is devoted to militarism. So I just sort of from an economic resource standpoint, unless we decrease our commitment to military spending, there will never be enough money or time or energy freed up to work on any of these other problems. And then lastly, I think I could argue for any of these issues being the most important. But I don't think it's enough to work on any one of them. I just think if we stem the tide on the environment or on poverty, if militaristic values in our society are still in place, we will inevitably harm the environment. We will inevitably deprive people of food. We will inevitably increase domestic violence in families. We will inevitably perpetuate racism. We will inevitably dehumanize women. Militaristic values, I think, inherently do that. So unless we somehow change that value system, I'm not sure we'll really completely tackle the other problems. But I think that's all I need to say. Okay.
Well, after hearing all these diverse issues, I feel like I should introduce myself and say that I'm Jackie and I'm a recovering schizophrenic, because it feels like there's a million ways you could go. Thank you. Hi, Jackie. I have to share some of my own history, I guess, to say that I started working in the field of addictions pretty naively, counseling back in 75. Didn't come from an alcoholic family, but in the course of beginning to work in that field, felt that I couldn't help but explore my own issues, which is sort of what happens to people who go into the sort of helping and psychological fields as they start to look at themselves. I wasn't doing a lot of peace and justice kind of work, but during that journey I started to look at some of my own personal brokenness, maybe some of my own family issues, and got some kind of framework to look at maybe spiritual, emotional sorts of personal issues, and then it really wasn't, and that was a converting experience for me in many ways, getting exposed to the whole 12-step programs that I think you'll hear more about from Peter this week was very converting in the sense that it helped me understand a lot more spiritual things that I had learned sort of religiously. In many ways, helped me to know the gospel over the law. I had a time there of sort of, I think, a lot of kind of personal self-growth and also faith. I wasn't doing a lot of what these kinds of folks were talking about in terms of the outer justice work, but I felt at some level I was making some kind of a difference in people's lives. And I loved seeing what happened to people in the course of of treatment and their involvement in groups like AA and Al-Anon and all the millions of other 12-step programs that are now happening, from Gamblers Anonymous to Overeaters Anonymous to Emotions Anonymous and Schizophrenics Anonymous and all of them that you know, and everything that you can get addicted to now. And I jokingly have told people that, you know, the latest one is Paranoids Anonymous, and I called up to find out where they were meeting and they wouldn't tell me. But anyway, that was a converting experience for me, working in that sort of psychological, self-growth-oriented kind of world. And then another converting experience was in 1980, hearing Archbishop Hunthausen at a peace conference at PLU when he announced his decision to do tax resistance. And my eyes kind of got opened, and I thought, there's a bigger world here, you know, there's some greater injustices happening. So started to do some volunteer work at the same time that I was working in a profit organization that was, you know, treating addicted people and their families, and began to sort of lift up this tension that we're talking about tonight. And then some unsettling was starting to happen to me, and that's about the point when I came to Holden. I was working in Bellevue at a really nice, beautiful clinic that was serving really affluent people who had health insurance, who could afford to come to therapy to analyze the families that they grew up in and navel gaze about their own life and wealth and psychological poverty. Something was a little bit unsettling for me, and that's the point that I decided to come to Holden. Well, then at Holden, you know, you get exposed to all these issues like you are all as guests. And then I also have had the opportunity this last year to travel in the developing world in Latin America and African India, and to see some of the real poverty that is much lower on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and people that are day-to-day struggling, unlike our psychological and relational and addictive suffering that we experience here as a people that are comfortable without but oppressed and empty within. And I think seeing more that here in the Western world, our values have brought us to a crisis of meaninglessness and a false sense of trying to find meaning in a possession, prestige, and power. And then it doesn't work, so we turn to ingesting and buying and trying to fill kind of our empty souls. And yet I can't deny that the years of working with people in addictions and struggling with interpersonal things, that self-growth focus gave me a framework to begin to maybe find some meaning in these tensions that we're talking about. Sometimes the 12-step programs have been summarized to say that they can be said in six things: trust God, clean house, and serve others. Well, the serve others part is now something that you know, has some questions for me, and I think the 12-step groups have been a way for me to counter some of the individualism of our culture. They're a community of people that don't have the sort of private me and Jesus mentality. I think the strength there is found not in independence or forcefulness and self-sufficiency, but rather in sort of weakness and vulnerability. I think that time of working in the self-growth-oriented field was also an opportunity to give me a model to view injustice. Yet now I struggle with the affluence of all that and see that it's a very money-making business to be a part of all of the addicted fields. And, you know, you walk into the B. Dalton bookstore and there are shelves and sections on all of the, you know, the psychobabble and the pablum, as many of the people here at Holden have challenged me to look at it. Some of that reeks kind of shallow now for me. It's become very chic to kind of know the addiction mentality and to be able to say, you know, I'm recovering this and I'm working on this and I'm codependent around this issue. And all of that now really challenges me when I've seen another world that's struggling with real basic life and death kinds of issues. And I don't think that the whole world of addictions can be a metaphor to be spread, you know, to all the problems that we have. And I think we can criticize some of that whole psychological arena for not recognizing the political and the social conditions that set the stage for individual and family problems that we have today. And yet, I think where we enter that circle of inner and outer, where we, you know, look at our inner struggle and yet try to be a part of the healing of wounded people, may mean that we need to get some treatment or some sort of... that we may at some point need to get some treatment to get started on that journey of where we work for justice and at what level we work for justice and for bringing in the kingdom. And I believe that the basic spiritual problem remains injustice, whether we look at it interpersonally or globally. I would just close by that saying that I've not resolved any of this tension myself yet. But I do find a lot of hope in the serenity prayer used by the 12-step groups and written by Reinhold Niebuhr, which is, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I guess we're all searching for that wisdom.
Thank you. These four people have shared something of their lives. The purpose of a holding forum is to listen to each one of us. Contrary to suggestion, perhaps popular belief, we're not going to vote at the end of the evening. The issue is to open it up to all of you now to share how you discover in your lives or how you decide how to prioritize issues.
Well, I guess personally, for myself, having dealt with the issue for almost 30 years of my life, being a gay man has certainly had an impact on me. And so that's kind of where I've chosen to put the main thrust of my efforts in attempting to educate and enlighten the church and society, the people I work with, my family, and anyone else who cares to learn more about the issues because of the long struggle I went through in dealing with that. And so I guess I relate a little bit to what Dick is saying about you can't tackle all issues and expect to accomplish. You can't move the world if you're addressing 10 different issues or whatever. That's not to say that I'm not concerned and that everyone here doesn't need to be concerned about all those issues. But I guess it's mainly a matter of what people's energies are, how much effect an individual can have on any given one given issue or a broad range of issues, how much do you split yourself up? How much do you? How much can you split your time and your efforts and your energy up? I guess I'd like to relate to one thing that Tom also said in one of his sessions a couple days ago. And I guess to me, the one thing that needs to be addressed first of all, well, and this goes back to what Jackie was saying here a little while ago also. First of all, I guess we have to resolve, at least to a certain extent, our own personal issues. We have to resolve the inner kinds of conflicts within ourselves and within our families and communities before we can have things together enough to focus on exterior issues. I think that, at least to a certain extent, has to happen. And then that goes to what Tom said a few days ago about dehumanizing people. And I think that the primary problem we have, not only in this country, but in other places around the world, is that we find it too easy to dehumanize other people and talk about this group or that group instead of putting faces to the issues, whether it's the environment or hunger or nuclear disarmament or whatever the issue may be. So I think maybe perhaps that overall is the most important issue that has to be addressed.
I'd like to ask Al, you know, Al, you were saying that you starting with yourself isn't a good place to begin, yet it seems like I'm hearing starting with yourself and straightening up your own psyche so you can get out and do some good. Where would you start, Al?
Well, I've said, I think in jest sometimes, I start on the 12th step of the 12-step rule, personally, and I don't know why, but that's what I think I do. Serve. And I just forget about all the other steps. That's just my situation, and I think it always has to. Simply find one issue. For a long time, it was race. I worked with Jesse Jackson 7 years. I worked with King when he was in Chicago, and Sarah and I were organizing his Chicago movement for him. And I find something that I thought the black issue was, we were just going to tear each other apart. Still, possibility. But now this other one seems important. So, in a nutshell, I start with a 12th step. And maybe, you know, maybe I've got all kinds of conflicts and all kinds of inner things I ought to be dealing with, but I don't.
I'd like to address that because I think there's a difference between what Al was saying about not starting as an individualistic consumer and looking at issues of self-worth, et cetera, that I think Jackie and some others have talked about. Because I think they're two very different issues. One talks about learning to value oneself and where you can start from a basis of concern for yourself, where you can show concern for others, and the other, the individualistic kind of grabbing what I can get for myself attitude, is one that I think is. What leads to a lot of the other problems of environmental abuse, of militarism, of poverty, because we're always trying to be on top. So those are, I think, two different issues, and both are important to deal with. But I think Al's point was that we don't start from that. Am I correct?
Well, you're absolutely correct. I mean, we start with God, and that means the universe. It means the whole. We are all a part of each other and of God. And if we start with God, we have to start with everybody and everything. And we have to look at it and say, how can I fit into everybody and everything in God's whole existence? Now, as I call this, acting toward God's future. What is God asking us to do today for the future of God's world? But I know, you know, my mentor once said that if people are psychotic, you don't preach to them. I mean, it will further drive them into their psychoses if you preach most of the stuff. It will not do it. Now, I know that with God everything is possible. So I buy into that enough to know that different people in different situations have to be treated very individually in terms of what their situation is. It's just clear that it's true. So you gotta do what's needed in the situation.
Yeah, well, when you're a junkie, it's pretty obvious where you start. You know, you start getting clean,
right.
And you get to go from there. I had to spend a lot of time trying to boil through what's my stuff, and what's society's stuff, and what's my mom and dad's stuff. And, you know, like I was shown that I was supposed to be married, And mom and dad, well, you know, I was supposed to have a fancy job and make money. And that stuff, I think that's what Jack was talking about, that was supposed to be important and it wasn't. You know, I mean, it lost its importance. It doesn't feel that good to go out and bang my head against walls that I don't like to make money, because that's what I'm supposed to do. So I had to get to know, rather than spending, like I'd spend a lot of time trying to see what I was supposed to be, you know, what do you want me to be and what should I be? That's what a lot of recovery is finding out what I am, not what I'm supposed to be, and not what I've been, but what I am. And that's how we were talking down at the soda shop. I'm pretty grateful. Like, my problem now is all the opportunities I've got. You know, what do I want to focus on? Not which guy is, you know, going to allow me into his house to buy dope tonight. That's not the, you know, the option I've got. I've got so many options, I'm confused, which is pretty cool.
I want to respond to some of this in that I agree with what you're all saying in the sense that we have great personal needs. It's obvious that one needs to start there. I think that, though, if you take it, I think what you were saying is that you need to straighten yourself out and then work on social issues. I'm not sure that I completely buy that. In that, I find it very debilitating because I don't feel like I have my life straightened out personally, and I never will. And mm-hmm. if that were my goal, I would never work on any other issue. And I feel like the reverse, and it's kind of a chicken and egg question. Sometimes working on something larger than yourself shapes yourself in a way that you hadn't expected mm-hmm. and changes people's individual lives. So I'm not sure I buy completely into the notion that one has to get one's life together, but I'm not sure that you were saying that. I know that, you know, what the issue you're working on is you're passionate about because it's touched your life and it's part of your life. That I'm wholeheartedly, I think we all have to work on something that touches our life.
Well, yeah, I don't know, Tom, that I was necessarily saying that all the questions have to be answered. Mm-hmm. But some of the basic questions have to be answered, and I think people need to feel good about themselves. That doesn't mean all the questions are answered. I mean, I don't have all the questions answered in my life any more than you do, or probably anybody else here.
Do we need to feel good about ourselves to be effective in the ministry?
One way to feel good about yourself is to participate in things that help other people. I mean, you also need those self-identity things too. I'm not really not disagreeing with you at all. I'm just trying to add another dimension to it.
I you know, like many people are saying, I think it's not an either-or thing, but a both-and thing. But it's real important to me in these areas to lift up the question of power and who has power in society and who hasn't, because I find that particularly when people who have traditionally been victimized by society, women, gay and lesbian people, people of color, are told that the starting point has to be service, that gets used to keep people in places mm-hmm. where they're oppressed, and they're told to deny their own experience as a starting point. And I think that's absolutely false. I think it's absolutely critical for people who have traditionally been excluded from power to begin to work together to understand their own experience, and out of that to work for their own liberation and the liberation of other people. It's like Tom was saying, when you find a point that touches yourself at a deep level, who you are as a person and who you are with other people, that becomes a creative source of energy to work with other things. In that sense, you know, the feminist slogan of the personal is the political, I think really is important. And I think that's one of the areas I've experienced the church to be very damaging at times, which is to tell people who've traditionally been victimized to always use a servant mentality, when those of us who have been oppressed need to start not with a servanthood motif, but learning from liberation and then working with other people. I think that, you know, we forget that the phrase of love your neighbor as yourself presumes you love yourself, and if you can't start at that point, it gets very negative to do the other stuff.
I think that's a very a reason that we often see people burning out in peace and justice work, for that very reason, that the message speaks to a personal issue, and very often it might be related to, you know, what kind of maybe organized religion experience they had, or what kind of family they grew up in, or what kind of previous oppression personally they might have experienced. And I think a lot of times people get into the service trying to really live out some guilt, or the motivation may also need examination as well. I don't know, I'm kind of playing the devil's advocate too, but.
I think you need to go down and in order to change. And then obviously that original to me, it's been from a lot of people, Chuck Lofty, somebody I heard from not too long ago. But the idea of going down and in order to change and to be able to move on to something else. So I guess I feel very strongly and have noticed that in my own life, that before, you know, I've tried to do a lot of helping and fixing and doing and being there for. And until I was ready to go down and into my own stuff and deal with that, I wasn't able to change to where I could begin to empower others. I was out there trying to help and fix. So I think it is essential that we start at home, and home inside ourselves, and a home with our own families. And it doesn't do the world a lot of good for us to be reaching out if things are in spoils close to home.
I'm sort of robbed of authenticity to speak to this now, because I'm not a woman. I'm not black, I'm not third world, and I'm not gay. For all that, I've lived around an awful lot of gay and straight men and women who, for whom all of that is true, but then go on to use it as an endless excuse never, never to make a sacrifice on behalf of poor people. So it's true, and I don't disagree with it. I couldn't disagree with it. But at some point, it becomes a rationalization only to deal with one's own reality, not you personally, because it's other people that I've dealt with. And I don't know where that point is, and I don't know where the line comes, but that's if you had before you the people who this moment die for lack of things we take for granted, if they were here right smack in your midst where that statue is, there would be kind of compelling power about that, that you might say, I could give 10% of my time to that. Or 10% a tithe, say. I don't know.
Okay, Barbara?
Well, I was just going to say, I think that it has to be, as Tom was saying, something that you connect with personally, because I think the activists that are most exciting and empowering to me, that can get me to work on their issue with them, are those who communicate a sense of joy about their work and about their cause, that draws from some kind of wellspring of depth and life-giving joy about that particular issue. And so it's going to be different for a lot of different one of us, because if I can't find that joy or see it in you working on some issue, it's not going to sustain my work. And then I just want to throw into the piece too the whole question of how much time you spend in prayer or worship, sort of in the inward, not maybe in the sense of counseling or psychological stuff, but the spirituality dimension, how much that should occupy relative towards action too, I think. And then the third piece that I really struggle with is how much time on study as well. I've had friends tell me that I was really doing the F. One of them being on your panel, doing a terrible thing and getting a doctor. That was about the most evil thing a person could possibly do in the world today, given all the pressing causes. and I think there's some truth to that, that entering into academia, just how much time, if the world, like Al's video says, only has 7 years left, well, I'm going to be in this doctoral program another 7 years. What a pathetic way to spend the So there's that whole piece. So I just wanted to throw in the joy and then the worship component and then also study. I don't know how they all fit together. But
let's put the other thing in there, the church. One needs routine. in the church, in a community, in the body of Christ, to do this, I think.
Or in a faith community. Yeah, Muslims do it too, Buddhists do it too.
Faith community. For me, it's the church. I have to be very personal. I'm not trying to thrust anything on you. I'm just saying, for me, there has to be a rooting in the body of Christ. And that's why this whole operation has to be within, on behalf of the church, the body of Christ. I mean, when I go back, I will be working. Either that or I'll create a whole new community with the church as the center of it.
I'm just curious, in the reading of New Testament, how much time we would consider that Jesus spent, you know, looking at his personal problems, and then how much time he spent.
He didn't have any.
He went into the wilderness. He went into the wilderness.
Sorry, I interrupted.
I told my church when I was home it would take me more than 40 days. I asked for 1 year off, and I had to have another year off. God wasn't talking to me enough yet.
There's something, I don't know if I can say it very clearly. Obviously, there's in what you all are saying, there's a call to an emergency or a set of emergencies existing in the world. A call to action, and I guess the question of tonight is, how do each of us decide where to act? But I sort of feel in myself, and I hear in what some people are saying about, well, I need to get my own little life in order. I hear in myself a response which is, I'm scared. I don't know if I can do that. I don't know if I can answer your call. Like, I've always been scared to write letters to congressmen and senators, for whatever reason. And I think that reaction from people who aren't already activists and out there, and I think that reaction needs to be taken seriously. We're not all, a lot of people feel insignificant and like they can't do anything. I think that reaction needs to be taken seriously and spoken to, accepted. Not that it has to be that way, but a lot of people feel that way.
I've got something to contribute, I hope. I have grandchildren.
Sorry.
I have grandchildren, and I wasn't, I'm not just,
oh, I'm sorry.
I wasn't finished.
I'm sorry, I thought you were. Go ahead.
No. Well, I was almost finished, but
I thought you were finished. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I'm finished now.
No, I don't. I have grandchildren, and I feel strongly about the environment, because I don't think that they have much of a life to look forward to. So, although I'm not the kind who gets out in front of the parade, I can affiliate myself with the groups that are taking effective action, at least as far as I can make out, and contribute to them. And financially and actively in certain ways, but I'm not the kind of dyslexia holding them and everything else. But it is a way, if you ally yourself with a group that seems to be effective and good, then you aren't doing it alone. It's like the bundle of faggots that's stronger than a single stick. And I'm doing it for my grandchildren, my children, because I want them to have a halfway decent environment to live in, or they're going to be dying of ghastly slow diseases. And I don't think there's an alternative.
I don't know where to start either, but one thing I hear is that all these people, maybe all they need is an effective leader or someone who, because everyone's all afraid to jump up, but if someone is sure of himself and is sure of what he's doing, and can clearly put down on paper what the cause is, and this is all you need to do is contribute this much of your time, and it's you know, here's a step to write that letter to Congress, and here's what you got to do. You need someone who can glow and say, yes, you can do it. Because I think there's not, I mean, when I see kids today, they're all just, I don't know, they need someone to lead. They need a mentor or something.
One of the questions I have also has to do with the North American now effort to focus on the environment and trying to enlist the help of the developing worlds who are saying, you know, look, you've had your Freon and refrigeration for years, and now it's our turn. We want what you've had, and you're asking us now to submit to your sort of rich, affluent, or Western solution, white solution to this problem, and to get on your bandwagon when we still want our charcoal for feeding our kids, and see that the environment is a sort of a detraction from the justice that needs to be done in terms of third world debt and hunger and so forth.
I agree with you very strongly, and that's why I want to say what my initial reaction to the whole question of the forum was. I think it's good to talk about prioritizing, because we cannot do everything. Each individual cannot do everything. But I believe that the issues are so strongly interrelated that, like Tom said, one affects the other. And I believe it's really important to see the interrelationships as we're working on one or another issue, so that we aren't blinded to the effects of our actions in one area, which might be overlooking, say, if we're trying to clean up the environment in the third world, overlooking the immediate needs of hunger and jobs in that area.
Well, I agree. I mean, one of the main thrusts that I'm working on, I actually have written a paper already, is on third world economic development. Very, very crucial in the whole environmental movement is to forgive the debt and change our farm supports and give them up and spend billions of dollars with them on relevant technology that they can develop themselves, and give them the money so they can do it, and all kinds of things have to be done. So the interrelationship is clear. The question is, where do you see the thing that really ultimately it's got to be addressed that will lead us to address all the related issues? That's why I see environment as something that has to be addressed. And in the course of it, I hope we will address everything.
There are bills before Congress on all of those items right now. The Farm Bill is up for reauthorization. It only comes up once every 5 years. What's in the Farm Bill? Food aid, food for third world countries, grain reserves, sustainable agriculture. There's a bill before the Congress on third world debt right now. There's a bill before Congress on cutting military spending. Those decisions are kind of getting made along the way on a day-to-day basis, and they are interrelated, clearly. I guess, to play my old saw again, what I'm interested in is not finally whether you go with poverty or environment or one of the other things we've talked about, but that part of your effort, part of it at least, goes toward political solutions, because that's where the big stuff happens.
Oh, I would never fight for that. We should have a carbon tax. We should be paying $3 a gallon for gasoline in this country. We should have a carbon tax on every single fossil fuel, and it ought to be. It ought to be a sin, not only a sin, but illegal to drive a car that doesn't get 50 miles a gallon today. At least to buy a new car that doesn't get 50 miles a gallon. I mean, they've got cars now, prototypes. In the 88 state of the world, prototypes that get 60, 70, 80, 90 miles a gallon.
Okay, we have time for maybe one more comment. We like to end forums on time, and we want to continue this. So, well, I see two hands, so we'll go with these two comments. Do you want to go ahead and then Luann?
One of the like, underlying themes to all this, and one of the reasons that that 80-mile-a-gallon car isn't out there is because of the big money people running the show. You know, if the fuel companies are not going to let a high, you know, that just isn't going to work. And I see, like, the Western addiction. It's addiction. It's if I can only have enough, if I can only have more than you, you know, if I can buy more, if I can eat more, you know, if we only have more Christians, it's always this more deal. And it's so American, it's so Western, you know, we always got to have more. So there's plenty of food in the world if you take this whole thing. But if some people have it all, some people don't have any. And that's how that works. And it can't be that, you know, until some people give it up, there's not enough to go around. You see, you know, I can tell the money comes out of the military. And look at Fragment and stuff, you know. It's like a gigantic universe, and we're all a chunk of it. And it's got to be taken into consideration that way. You know, looked at from a whole.
Thank you. Can you sum everything up?
Put in a plug for both the interpersonal and for study. I have to do
the PhDs.
Take a moment. But on the interpersonal, I think that that also is so interrelated with the other issues, because if people are not dealing with issues of conflict, of hurt, of fear on an interpersonal level, it gets projected in militarism, in oppression of others. I think those are so strongly interrelated. And my plug for study, when I came back from El Salvador last winter, I had a crisis about my PhD program. I talked to my pastor, should I continue this? Should I go into justice work? I really had and that's been true throughout my life. I've been studying a long time, working in justice a long time, environmental issues. I sort of make the rounds of the issues. And but I believe that it's also helpful to look at the roots of attitudes and behaviors, and study, feminist study does that in looking at what's happening to in interpersonal relations, and what's been our history in issues of relationships between men and women. So there are just lots of things that there are roots of oppression of others that need to be studied and brought out and brought to light.
Okay, amen. Thank you to everybody. We hope these conversations will continue as we struggle with these issues throughout the week.